you. I'm sorry I wasn't here for your debate on Friday. As you gathered, I snuck away for a little conference in Italy on interdisciplinarity and creativity, which was very interesting. But I know you discussed some very interesting themes, one of which was the future of the disciplines. And in a sense, you could think that everything we've talked about thinks about where this whole journey is going with regard to the disciplines. So I'm absolutely delighted to have here Professor Steve Fuller from the University of Warwick. He holds the chair in Auguste Comte, chair in sociology at the University of Warwick. I think it's absolutely no exaggeration to say he's one of the world-leading thinkers about interdisciplinarity per se as a thing in itself. And so I'm absolutely delighted that Steve's here today to talk to us about the future of the disciplines. Thank you, Steve.
Okay. Well, thank you. You should never applaud until after you hear the talk. But first, let me thank Carl once again. This is the second year I've been addressing this class. And each year it's a little bit different what the context is in which I'm speaking into. But I want to, the thing I want to focus on, so I'll speak for maybe 30, 35 minutes, and then hopefully there'll be some time for me to take some questions from you to close out the hour. The question about the future of disciplines. As I understand, one of the propositions that was on the table on Friday was whether the university is going to continue to be organized along disciplinary lines. I am against this idea, not only against this idea in the sense that I don't think it's going to be that, but also I think it might be the wrong way of doing it too. So this is kind of the, you might say, the starting point from which I'm going to talk to you about the future of disciplines. And of course, to talk about the future of disciplines, one needs to begin by saying where disciplines came from in the first place. And as you probably know, the university as an institution, as we understand as an institution, is maybe 800 years old, right? Places like Oxford and Bologna in Italy and Paris in France, all these places are among the places where the first universities were founded. And typically, there were two kinds of things going on in universities in terms of what was being taught, and primarily what was being taught, okay? Research was a kind of a secondary thing. And if you go back to the Middle Ages, which is the period that I'm talking about here, and you look at the titles that the people who were working in universities had, you had some of the people who were called masters, okay, and some were called doctors. But they didn't quite correspond to what these terms mean today. The people who were masters were basically people who, in a sense, had a kind of mastery of what we would now, I think, would call a skill, a transferable skill. And so some of you who know something about the sorts of things that were normally taught in the Middle Ages, right, in terms of the disciplines that were involved, they were basically disciplines that were very skill-based. They would kind of train you to speak in a certain way, train you to reason publicly in a certain way, train you to see. So astronomy, you know, as a subject, the key thing about it was actually to improve your powers of observation. Right? So in other words, the issue wasn't so much trying to come up with new knowledge, but rather the skills that are embodied in undergoing the discipline. And so rhetoric, logic, grammar, you think about the sorts of things that would be taught at that level where one would want to acquire a mastery. And what would be the result of that would be that then you become a kind of refined, sophisticated person. You become a proper human in that sense, not just a mere Homo sapiens, okay? But you become a proper human. So it's a bit like finishing school. Right? Even though it's very sophisticated and a lot of very intellectually interesting things were done, the spirit in which the disciplines were being taught to students at this kind of level was as a finishing school. Right? So you sound good, people trust your authority, you know, all that kind of stuff. Now with the doctors, we have a different sort of range of disciplines going on there. And these are the disciplines you might say are of a kind of administrative character. Law, medicine, right? Theology. Each of these disciplines, which are very much part of the foundation of the university as well, are disciplines that in some sense establish a kind of jurisdiction of governance, right? So theology governs your soul, right? The law would govern secular relations, right? Medicine would govern the body, okay? And one would be a doctor, and doctor means a teacher, and what teacher means in this context is a bit kind of like the way the doctor and the GP treats you today. A slightly condescending way where they're basically instructing you on how your own body works. Okay? So in other words, you, the possessor, don't actually have the final authority. You don't really know what's going on. You got to go to this guy to tell you. And this is true of theology and law as well. Okay? And so there's this kind of administrative function of disciplines, which establishes a kind of governance structure for the society, and that's why the people who were part of the elites in the society, you know, into the present day, have gone to university, because there's always been that kind of administrative function. Okay? Nowadays, of course, we call these people who are engaged in this kind of doctor mode professionals, right? That's the general word that gets used. And the whole idea of calling them professionals has to do with the idea that they profess a kind of code of ethic, right? Because they realize they are actually, you know, in some sense, taking responsibility for your life, so they have to be doing it the right way. And so that's why it's there's a profession of a faith, right? You can trust me because I promise I will do this. Okay? And you know about the Hippocratic Oath in medicine, for example? Do no harm, right? That's kind of, that's where all this kind of stuff comes from, and it was very much part of the original idea of the university. Now, let's just focus on the doctor side for a moment, because in a sense, our modern notions of academic disciplines in terms of the, you know, the subject matters of the humanities, social sciences, natural sciences, they kind of grew out of that end for the most part. The humanities, to a certain extent, grew out of the master side. But in terms of the way in which we think about disciplines today, they come out of the administrative side. So that when someone is actually seen to know something about a discipline, they have a kind of jurisdictional knowledge over an area of reality. And that's what we mean by expertise. Right? Expertise, that's what expertise is. Meaning, I went to university, I got this degree now allows me to pontificate on these matters, right, because the degree says I can. This is very much in the doctor mode, and you don't even need to have a doctoral degree to be able to operate in this fashion. But that's, in a sense, where the modern disciplines kind of come from, this sort of mentality, right? So if you go back to the Middle Ages, and you think about law, theology, and medicine, those three disciplines, you might say, were dividing up kind of the lived world of the people who were around at the time in terms of administering to them. But what you start to get in the 19th century is this kind of meta-level conception of discipline, where what the jurisdiction is over reality in a much more conceptual sense. Right? So when we talk about the division between the humanities, the social sciences, and the natural sciences, at one level, they're all talking about the same thing. Right? But on the other hand, right, they're slicing it conceptually in a different way. Okay? And so this kind of idea of thinking about the disciplines as a kind of conceptual organization of knowledge. Right? We talk about maps of knowledge and stuff like that. Those are metaphors, but they're very powerful ones, because what they do is they accept that it carries over the idea of jurisdiction where there's expertise implied. Right? So if you're someone within this domain, you're the boss. Right? And so the whole issue of expertise is built around that kind of conception. Okay? Now, question arises as to exactly how do these disciplines maintain themselves over time? And this is a very crucial matter for addressing whether the future of the university is going to be organized along disciplinary lines. Because there's disciplines, you might say, it's a certain kind of sociological phenomenon. Right? It's a certain way of organizing how people relate to knowledge. The field that I'm known for is called social epistemology. Okay? That is basically about the social organization of knowledge. And so the question is, what's distinctive about a discipline as opposed to all other sorts of ways in which knowledge can be gathered and transmitted? I mean, you think about now in the kind of world that we live in cyberspace, where you can crowdsource information, right? You can do all kinds of searches, right? There's a lot of ways in which knowledge can be organized and transmitted. But disciplines have a very kind of specific character to them. And this is true whether we're talking about the Middle Ages or in the present day. And the point I would put on the table to you is that disciplines are very much what economists would call path-dependent entities. That is to say, their histories, where they come from, anchor the way they develop. Okay? For better or worse. Okay? We have a discipline called sociology, of which I am a professor. And sociology is a discipline that is concerned about the nature of society. Fair enough. But, you know, let's say you don't know anything about sociology, but you hear this discipline exists, and you're sort of asking yourself, what, how does this discipline operate? What does it think about? What does it write about, etc.? You might be surprised, perhaps, what you end up finding once you go to sociology journals and read sociology books. You might say, this is not quite what I was expecting when I took sociology. All I see here is a lot of mumbo-jumbo and jargon, etc. And I'm using my own discipline as an example, but you could use your own discipline, frankly, okay? It's not just me, okay? But the point here is that that mumbo-jumbo, that jargon, is reflective of the path-dependent nature of sociology. In other words, sociology began at a particular point in time, actually in a few points in time, roughly around the same period in the late 19th century, and there's some major figures who were involved in the development of the field, and those guys laid down a certain kind of conceptual way of understanding society, right? And that was to understand the society of the late 19th, early 20th century. Nevertheless, those concepts continue to carry on. People build on those concepts. They add other concepts as well. But the point is, the discipline of sociology that we see today, even though it is dealing with a society that is radically different from the one that existed in the late 19th, early 20th century, nevertheless, you can see the lineage. There's still a lot of the same concepts being used. Maybe more sophisticatedly, you know, whatever, maybe a lot of discussion about them. I mean, you think about the standing of someone like Karl Marx, right? Karl Marx is part of the beginning of the field, and he's still there. Okay? And in a way, you know, if you're trying to understand society and you come at it now without knowing anything about the history of the discipline, you might ask, why is Karl Marx being so important in this field? He's just some 19th century dude. I mean, but nevertheless, that has to do with the way the discipline developed. Okay? And, you talk about physics and, you know, Newton. Right? Newton still matters. He still matters. You know, people might say, we've gone beyond Newton. But the key point is Newton, right? It's beyond Newton. It's not like Newton doesn't have any relevance to the field anymore. No, Newton is the guy we build on, is the guy we've gone beyond. So even a field like physics, so-called gold standard of knowledge, right, is itself path-dependent, right? And in a sense, you know, if you want to understand where we are now and what sorts of theories in physics are considered relatively plausible or implausible, you have to know where physics came from. Okay? And this is true for every field. And this is what makes these fields path-dependent, which means, as a matter of fact, right, that there's a sense in which, like it or not, however much disciplines like to see themselves, you know, as very vanguard and cutting-edge and all the rest of it, are very tradition-bound. Right? They're very tradition-bound, in a way. Even if the people practicing the disciplines don't know very much about the histories of their field, nevertheless, they are still living reenactments of that history to a certain extent. So, for example, the kinds of mathematics that one would do to solve physics problems today, right, most of it would not be alien to someone like Newton. Because that's how he solved physics problems, okay? He didn't operate within the same conceptual framework, that's changed. But, you know, if he were to come back here today and watch a couple of you do some, you know, some equations and things like that, he'd know what you were doing, right? Because that's what physics is, and it builds on what he was doing. Okay? Now, this, you know, economics. Are any of you economists? Anyone here an economist or an aspiring economist? You don't have to be embarrassed about it.
They may not admit it, because I've had a go at economics a few times.
Okay, well, I'm going to say some nice things about it.
Okay, good.
Because in a sense, economics is the most critical discipline around. Economics takes nothing, doesn't respect anything. Right? Economics is, you know, if you want to talk about a field that has a very kind of bottom line, which is where that, you know, term comes from, right, it is economics. And so when economists see things that are path dependent, so when economists talk about path dependency, they're often talking about how there's a kind of, you know, in the history of innovation, you know, let's say you're trying to figure out, okay, we want this kind of automotive transport vehicle in the early 20th century. And Henry Ford's car comes into play. There are a lot of other people doing stuff. Henry Ford comes into play. And then you get technological lock-in. Right? In other words, he dominates. He becomes the one. And the history of automobiles follows that path. And all the other possibilities, including electric cars and things like that, go by the wayside. And then it becomes very hard to retrieve them, right? Because the path dependency is so strong with regard to technological development.
Well, this happens in science too. This is the point. This happens in science too. It's just that in science, there's a tendency to valorize this. Whereas in technology, people are a little more, you know, in a sense, technologists are a little less mystified about their own history. Right? They're always thinking about ways of what, you know, Joseph Schumpeter, the economist, called creative destruction. Right? So, you know, in other words, sort of operate on the assumption that the market is radically wrong and that there's a whole new way of going about doing things. And so you're sort of motivated as an entrepreneur to actually try to radically reopen the market. But this is not really how science operates. Right? Science is very much operating on this very discipline-based basis, which means that part of what you have to do is, first of all, show a mastery of the kinds of skills that, in fact, all the people before you have shown, right? So you've got to pass all the exams all the people before you have passed, of course, right? Maybe there's a more abbreviated way of doing it, otherwise you'd be in school forever. But in fact, in science, it's quite common now for people to spend forever in school and have postdocs that go till the cows come home. So, you know, just at the time you're about to get a regular appointment, you're ready for retirement. But luckily, pensions are going to disappear, so it won't matter. Okay? So the thing here is that science has this kind of presupposition that you are going to be building on what took place in the past, and that's a good thing. Right? And that's a good thing. You're not trying to erase the past. You're not trying to displace the past. You're trying to build on the past. Right?
In economics, again, another term for you, there's this idea of sunk cost. Right? When you've been digging a hole long enough, why dig more? Okay? And there's a sense in which one might look at certain kinds of developments in science and make this kind of judgment about them. Namely, these are fields that have attracted a lot of people, generated a lot of income, done a lot of stuff in a way of having a lot of journal publications, but have they actually solved real problems? Right? Or is this just a kind of make-work scheme for overintelligent people? Right? And so this is a kind of sub-cost kind of analysis that an economist would bring to bear on disciplines. That in fact you need to start from a different position. It's not enough just to keep on going along the same road. Okay? And so this is the problem that disciplines sort of face, is this kind of path dependency. Now the way you see the path dependent character of science unfold if you're sort of a reader of the scientific literature. And by science here, I don't just mean the natural sciences. I'm not trying to target them specifically. It covers all of the disciplines. Social sciences and humanities, in many respects, are worse offenders than the natural sciences are. Okay? But all these fields is, if you look at the way articles are written, okay, and here I want to draw your attention to a very obvious feature about the way in which articles are written in academic literature, which is very much a mark of how you as an author establish your disciplinary credentials. And that's the citation system, the referencing system, right? One of the things about academic articles, if you look at them and you compare them with other kinds of prose works that are available to read, is that they are heavily referenced. They are heavily referenced. In fact, articles may not get published if they are not referenced heavily enough. Okay? And this is true across all fields. And you have to be referencing the right things. Right? And this, in a sense, does a lot, actually, of work for scientific credibility. Because, let's say I'm a person in your field, and I'm sent your article to review to decide whether I should publish it, whether you should publish it in this journal that we, in a field we're both in. And I read the article. Am I actually going to check out what you've actually claimed to have done in your experiment or whatever? Am I going to be in a position to do that? Can I actually review that? Can I actually review what you've done in that kind of literal way? No, but what I can do is I can look at your references. Because if you've read the same things I've read, then there's a good chance that you're a decent person and you ought to get published. It's kind of like that. It's kind of like that. Now, what this means then is that academia, and this goes to the disciplinary structure of academia, is very much what I would call a debtor culture. It is a culture where you get credibility by saying you owe everything to everyone else. Right? Originality is actually something that's only tolerated in the last resort. Right? The rest of the time, you've got to have everything referenced. There's got to be some backstory going on, right? It's got to make you've got to write the article in such a way that if people had the same reference as you had, they could have come up with it themselves. Okay?
In other words, there is no real admission in academic writing of originality as a value. Of course, some people get recognized as original, of course, that's of course the case, but I think you would have a very serious problem making an academic career within a discipline if one of the things you keep on striving to do is to be original, right? In other words, trying to say things that there's no precedent for. Then you get in big trouble, right? And people do get into big trouble, and that's why they leave academia. It's not because they're too, you know, they're not smart enough or something. It's because they don't want to subject themselves to this kind of disciplinary regime, because this is where you, as an author of scientific work on a regular basis, are reenacting the disciplinary structure, the path dependency of it. The fact that, you know, you can see as far as you have because you stood on the shoulder of giants, right? Newton uses this to describe his own success. This phrase, you've probably heard of this phrase, standing on the shoulders of giants. It was originally coined in the Middle Ages, and it was meant sarcastically back then. In other words, even a dwarf can see behind, you know, others if they just stand on top of them. Okay? And this kind of captures sort of the mentality of discipline-based work, right? It's one where you're always building on others. And so it becomes very difficult. Now, you might ask, well, then how does radical change happen in science? Because, you know, we have Einstein's revolution, we have Darwin, right? We have all these different figures in the history of science who've been very radical people, okay? I mean, of course, the first part of the answer is, well, maybe they're not so radical, okay? So we'll put that to one side. But the interesting thing is, if you want to grant everything I've said so far about the way in which the disciplinary culture shapes the way scientific knowledge is produced, then you have to ask yourself, well, then how do you get radical on the back of that? And this is where I do think there's something to be said for the work of Thomas Kuhn, who I'm normally very, very critical of, but I think in the context of this discussion, you know, the one thing that I think Kuhn definitely understood was that science is this discipline-based thing, right? Normal science is the name of the game, and no science changes until it self-destructs. In other words, when it is no longer possible to go forward simply by building on others, but that in some sense you have to start from a whole new foundation, that is when the revolution occurs. But that is something that is not promoted from the outside. That is something the scientific community eventually discovers for itself. And it may take a very long time. And one of the ways you know it takes a long time is because often that is the incentive they have to read all of these critics from 100 years ago. That's when a lot of these old forgotten guys who were against the system start to get revived and reinvented. Okay? So Kuhn, in a way, captures this kind of crazy dynamic, you might say, to science. And Kuhn's punchline to all this, if you've not read Kuhn's work, is the way in which science maintains its coherence, given that it is primarily this very tradition-based disciplinary culture, yet has all these revolutions, is that after the revolution, the history gets rewritten to make it look like whatever turns out to be the new dominant paradigm is where all this stuff was going all along. So you start creating a whole new cycle of disciplinization, a whole new set of path dependencies through a rewriting of history, basically. Okay? So Newton doesn't disappear from the history of physics, but his significance shifts, right? So everything gets readjusted. Okay.
So there's one more point I want to make before I open it up, and this has to do with the future of disciplinarity.
One of the reasons why the disciplinary culture, as we understand it today, has been promoted in the way you normally encounter it in scientific journal articles, with all this heavy referencing and so forth. I mean, to make a long story short, a lot of it has to do with the fact that there is no alternative way to find out some of the stuff being talked about in the articles. That, I think, is the most benign reading, right? So one of the reasons why you want technical articles to have a lot of references in them is not just because you're trying to, you know, pay your respects to all the people who came before you.
You're like Darth Vader for a moment. No, but the mic's been funny.
What? So?
I tried again. It just went very strange for a moment.
There you go. These disciplinarians, they'll get at you. I'm going to self-destruct in a moment now. and they'll be replaced by a new paradigm. But the thing here is that if you look at the referencing structure, even if you can go beyond just simply saying, oh, these are just people who are paying undue respect to everybody from the past. The reason why you want a very large reference list is because you may genuinely not know what's being talked about in the article unless you've got the references and to follow them up. Okay? And this is especially true if you don't have access to all the materials that the author of the article had access to. But now we live in a somewhat different world. This is where things start to get interesting, right? Nowadays, when people are interested in finding out about stuff, and I'm not just talking about ordinary people, but even academically trained people, because the level of academic training in the population has actually been rising, generally speaking, okay? Also, we now have greater and greater access to information resources through the internet and so forth, that it now actually becomes possible, and people are increasingly trying to find out where ideas come from for themselves. So in other words, they can pick up an article, and they can read through it, and whatever they don't understand, they don't necessarily have to take the author's word from where the idea comes from. They can search for it themselves and make their own conclusions about where this idea is really coming from. And then they can start putting it together and recontextualizing what it is that the author is on about. The reason why I say this is because in the future, it's going to become easier, actually, if part of what referencing is supposed to do is to actually give a kind of map to where ideas are coming from. We're already getting very good at doing that ourselves through the information technology that's available. So the whole referencing system of academic writing may eventually just be unnecessary. And so then the question becomes, why do you want to cite people? And this is where the issue of the debtor culture comes in. Who do you really want to recognize? Who do you really want to pay respect to? Who do you want to really say your ideas are indebted to? Okay? And if we actually went down that route, we would actually have quite a different sort of conception of how academic life operates. And it would, in fact, be one that would, to a certain extent, be de-disciplinized. In other words, when you read a scientific article, you don't necessarily have to understand it in the way in which the author read it, but maybe there might be certain things that the author highlights that you want to pick up on, okay? And with the rest of the time, you can start thinking perhaps more creatively about the use of the resources that are made available through the creation of academic knowledge, right? So in other words, you don't have to be responding within the narrow disciplinary confines. Once it's possible not to have to rely on the reference lists of the articles that people write. Okay? So there are two issues here at play. One issue has to do with the maintenance of disciplinary culture in terms of the organization of knowledge. And that's what the reference list certainly gives you. It gives you a certain way in which you show how you get into a topic. But my argument is that's becoming obsolete. Because we've got the internet, we've got other ways of getting into topics without having to rely on the way the author got into the topic, okay? But then on the other hand, we still have this issue of recognition and respect to people who came before us. And there is something to be said for that. It's just whether it should be the whole, you know, raison d'etre, the whole main reason why we do academic work. It's just to basically pay respects to our predecessors. And I certainly don't think that should be the reason, okay? So I'm hoping that side of things kind of diminishes over time. And so that people, the only people who are recognized in one's own writings are the ones who deserve to be recognized by virtue of our actually having a genuine debt to them, not because we feel we need to cite them in order to get published. Okay? But that's kind of where we are today with regard to disciplinarity in the academy. But my view about this is that as the internet kind of takes over everything, it's going to very seriously challenge in the way I've been talking about this notion of disciplines as being foundational to the university. Okay, I'll stop here and take some questions. Questions? Yes, sir.
I was just thinking about the idea of the paradigm shift from Kuhn's work. And I was thinking about whether we could actually consider Einstein to be completely radical in terms of breaking the path dependency, because the institutions of knowledge that recognized his theories still kept the same ideas of truth and evidence. Than they had before, and I was then wondering if we could even break this path dependency, still having the same institutes of knowledge defining what's truth, and what's evidence and so on, thinking about journals and so on. So whether it would be necessary for us to find new ways of defining what's relevant and what's not, and even new institutions to define what's relevant.
Well, this is where I think, see, because remember, you know, this is where I, this is one of the reasons why I think that the disciplinary structure will have to disappear, because disciplines presuppose, as I said earlier in the talk, a kind of conceptual map of all of reality, which is divided up in certain ways by the disciplines. And what you're saying is that there are all these different modes of access and different ways of getting at things, very much kind of like the way we usually think about the internet, actually, right? Where you can get in at many different levels and cover similar ground in different ways, and it's not just a matter of you either look at this or you look at that. And so I tend to agree with you on this. I think there's a sense in which that the structure of the way knowledge is organized and taught and researched in universities is going to have to more effectively mirror what we're beginning to see emerging from information technology. I guess that would be the, just like the, you know, just like the Gutenberg printing press radically reformed how knowledge was produced in the West, okay? Especially when books became readily available and it wasn't necessary to write down in your book everything of every other book you read. Right, you only needed to reference things because other people had the books. Okay, this is a revolution quite similar in terms of reorganizing and restructuring how we think about knowledge. But remember, universities will still be around because, in a way, this is a punchline of what I'm saying. Right, universities have been around, like I say, for 800 years. Right, and they've gone through all these technological revolutions and have reformed themselves. And the point that I would make to you is just that the disciplinary structure, as we understand it today, like humanities, social sciences, natural sciences, and all the subdisciplines. That's likely to disappear, right? That's likely to disappear. Yes?
This may be a bit too complex to tackle in the short space.
Oh, nothing's too complex.
I just wanted to ask, I watched some of the lectures that Carl shared with us where you talk about transdisciplinarity.
Yeah.
And the idea of disciplines being made for solving problems.
Yeah.
And I was a bit confused about that difference between interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary. Could you explain that?
Okay, well, see, I mean, in the way this, you're familiar with, I mean, there's a kind of a, you might say it's where the term is coming from, right? Interdisciplinarity is a kind of term that comes from within the academy, from people like Carl and myself, who see that the way our knowledge is organized is in some sense fundamentally inadequate to addressing problems, not just real world problems, but even academic problems, right? And so interdisciplinarity is a kind of response to that, a kind of internal problem with disciplinary boundaries being too rigid, too much path dependency in the system. We in academia recognize this for ourselves. So interdisciplinarity, you might say, is the kind of first pass solution to this, before we get to this kind of radical world that I was talking about. Transdisciplinarity comes from the other end. Transdisciplinarity comes from the fact that there are real world problems, like it or not. Real world problems, regardless of whether academics are thinking about it or not. Right? And then the question becomes, given that the real world problems exist, so they're transdisciplinary, they exist outside the academy, right? They're out there, right? That then the question becomes, how does the academy respond? How does it organize itself, right? So very often, the kind of drivers for transdisciplinarity from a sociological standpoint come from government, business, right? I mean, that's kind of what often the drivers are, right? Because there are certain problems in society that need to be addressed, and the way the disciplines are organized, it's quite clear it's not going to happen by itself. The academic incentive structures aren't set up properly, so as a result, we need new institutes, government-funded institute, you know, that will specialize in, you know, some kind of important social problem. And then you get people from many different disciplines working in. Okay. Yes?
I was just wondering, like, wouldn't the path dependency be a harder thing to solve than, even if we decided we wanted to completely reorganize disciplines within the university, isn't a path dependency and building on past knowledge, that's just kind of how most people think, isn't it?
That's, well, I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question, right? I mean, you let's say that's true. Let's say what you're saying is true. That could never, it's not at all obvious that the point of a university ever was to just reinforce ordinary ways of thinking, right? So there's always been, in some sense or another, something of a disruptive function to common sense, ordinary ways of thinking, etc., as far as the university is concerned. You know, so I give you, you know, here's an interesting kind of sidelight on this. I didn't mention this in the talk, but it's relevant to this. You've heard of Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon is often seen as the founder of the scientific method. Now, he was a guy who, in a way, was very much worried about this question, about overcoming the way in which people naturally think. Because the way people naturally, and he didn't like path dependency at all. And so he hated the way in which the medieval university was organized and everything. And in fact, what he calls the scientific method is kind of a solution, you might say, to the path-dependent tendencies in the way in which people think about things. That's kind of the way you can interpret what he was about. But the thing that he proposed, and this is you know, you might want to think about this. He thought knowledge ought to be reorganized along the lines of how the human mind is organized. In other words, not just he's not talking about the default patterns of thinking, the biases and prejudices and, you know, the narrowness of our thinking, but rather looking at the full scope of our minds. So we have perception, we have cognition, we have memory, and our discipline should be reflective of all of those faculties, as it were, with each discipline kind of amplifying one of those mental faculties. That's how he wanted to see the university organized. Like a big brain, literally, right? Would be like a big brain in our term, right? And so the discipline, so, you know, that would, you know, so each lobe of the brain would be like a discipline, okay? And he thought that would be the way in which human beings would be able to maximally exploit, right, you know, all their capacities for thinking. That was his idea, and he even had these pictures of it and so forth. I mean, admittedly, it's early 17th century, so I'm not saying this guy's some flaming neuroscientist, but you know, he did the best. That was kind of, you know, he was on this wavelength, right? He kind of was sensitive to the issue you were raising, and so he said, you need a radically restructuring of the university. And his idea actually got played around a lot during the Enlightenment. In the Enlightenment, there were a lot of different proposals for reorganizing universities along the lines of how the brain is divided. And since they had many different theories about how the brain was divided, they had many different accounts of how knowledge should be. Yeah?
If looking at sociology, if you consider society as something that's developed out of previous societies and is kind of path-dependent itself, do you think the discipline has to then develop out of its previous society?
Yeah, well, there you go. Are you a sociologist?
I don't really define myself.
This is the man who's speaking to us from the future. No, because that's a really good question, right? Because it's true that one of the path-dependent features of sociology is when Emil Durkheim, who's often seen as the founder of the field, when he conceptualized the society, and he called society sui generis, you know, this is a Latin phrase, mean, you know, of its own kind. So society is not reducible to just individuals and so forth. It's a thing in itself. This is what he was arguing. What he had in mind, quite specifically, was a nation state. That's a society. So Britain would be a society, okay? And the history of sociology, I would say, until we get to the 1960s and 70s, so Durkheim's writing originally in the 1890s, 1960s and 70s pretty much took that as given. And that's where ideas like social problems become important. Because what makes something a social problem? Well, you need to have some sense of what a society is, and where the problems are in it. So you need a boundary for the thing, and the boundary was the nation state. And this is why sociology was always so much connected with welfare state politics and, you know, that, all that kind of stuff. That's why it was very much aligned with that. But once you don't believe in the nation state, this is my point, right? Once your image of what social is, or what a society is not bounded by the nation state, but let's say it's a network-based idea, right? So the people who are part of my society are the people who I'm in regular interaction, you know, on the internet with. That blows sociology out of the water. And indeed, sociology has, for the last 20 years, I would say, been playing that kind of catch-up to, as it were, bring in the old concepts to sort of capture all this new phenomena that is being generated as people's ideas of the social migrate from the nation-state idea to perhaps a more network idea, a more ecological idea, right, where we're, in a sense, you know, you can have a society and it's not all just human beings. It could be animals as well in there. You know, I mean, all of these things are shifting, and it's causing problems for the field. There's no doubt about it. But you're right. That's an example of where sociology is very clearly path-dependent by its initial conception of society. Yes?
So you were saying that it's a good thing that science kind of builds on itself. But when you've got this kind of echo chamber sort of ideal in academia, and you've also got ideas that have been proven to be wrong, that the ones that self-destruct, don't you think that's kind of dangerous?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the thing, you know, in a way, there's an interesting kind of more general question about how academia's been able to survive like this, right? And I think that speaks to the relatively protected status of academia as an institution, universities and institutions. And this is why we live in very interesting times with regard to this. Because basically, let's put it this way. As long as universities can justify themselves to the larger world on their own terms, then the sort of stuff, this discipline stuff will continue forever. Because that's the kind of default pattern for academics. That's how academic training works. That's how, you know, if you think about how academia works in general, it's very well set up to continue this disciplinary thing forever. That's as long as the academics can get away with justifying their existence to the world this way. But once you have to start justifying your existence in some other way, then the value of the discipline-based culture starts to get called into question very quickly, okay, very quickly. So even in this country, as you know, increasing levels of accountability for universities demanded by both public and private forces impinging on the university sector. In the case of universities that, for whatever political or financial reasons, are relatively weak, so-called new universities, for example, those guys rearrange their structures like rearranging the furniture, right? They're just purely responsive to whatever the outside pressures are in terms of why the society that they happen to be responsive to needs knowledge. And so they no longer pay attention to disciplines at all, right? You go to any of these new universities, you'll be lucky to see a discipline somewhere as a marker of any kind of institutional structure. The ones that do preserve the disciplines are like this place and my place, right? These kind of old, established places that can put up a kind of bulwark, you know, against the outside world in various ways. Okay? And of course, we have to be accountable to the larger society, but you might say we can defer the moment, right? We could say, well, you know, if you look long enough, our graduates do wonderful things 50 years after they leave here, you know? This kind of stuff. And people buy this nonsense, right? I mean, that's the point, right? People still believe that. You know, or we've been producing brilliant people for the last 500 years, so therefore we'll be doing it for the next 500 years. You know, the Oxford line. Right, because that's kind of what the argument boils down to when it gets down. And the thing that is striking is how persuasive that still is. Right? But you can see that Britain is a very interesting experiment in this regard, because there are all of these pressures for, you know, trying to force universities to account for themselves in non-disciplinary ways. And some universities collapse, like the new universities, and basically just become whatever the person paying for it wants them to be. And others kind of maintain the position. They call it integrity, but it's kind of conservatism. Right? But it's what passes for integrity in academia these days. It's holding your line and don't change unless you want to. There was some, yes?
So how do you think the institutions will evolve sustainably?
My view is there'll be fewer universities, okay? I think there's a whole other lecture to be had here about why we have so many universities to begin with. It's not that we need so many, given the different functions that they perform and so forth. I think at the end of the day, let's put it this way, I think the solution to the problem will be that a lot of these things that are called universities now will change their character. They will become more like, you know, vocational schools and things like that, and more directly responsive to various kinds of client consumer needs. And universities like this one and the ones at the top level will actually learn to become more internally dynamic. And so part of what their function will be to kind of be vanguard institutions. They will be the places where you would learn the stuff that the next generation of people need to know. I think that would be the best way for a kind of elite institution like this to build itself in the future, not just providing somehow gold standard discipline-based knowledge, but rather being the place where next generation's thinking is already happening.
So you're saying it's going to be a more problem-based approach?
Not necessarily, no. Because, I mean, it doesn't have to be problem. So in other words, I'm not saying problem-based, but I am saying it's the kind of place where the new concepts, the emerging new concepts that'll be important to take forward in whatever you're thinking about will come from. And by the way, this is one argument, part of what's in the back of my mind here, and again, reflecting on the history of the university, one of the ways in which universities have historically adapted in the 19th and 20th centuries was by learning the best from the emerging industry, okay? Because universities had two kinds of responses to the rise of industrialization and capitalism in the 19th and 20th century. One was to just ignore it and say, oh, they're bad people, or they're not really doing real knowledge. And the others were to get to some kind of accommodation where you sort of, in a sense, academicize it. So all of the good and brilliant ideas that are already out there, let's say in something like Silicon Valley, you bring them in and put them in center stage within the university culture. Okay? I think that's going to be a very important thing that's going to happen in the long term. And part of that is also going to have to do with incorporating in a much more full-throated way things like information technology. which is still something that, you know, academics are kind of very resistant, etc., that this will have to become much more integral. I mean, one thing I would suggest to you is look in the 19th century at the resistance that Oxford, Cambridge, and a lot of the elite universities put to having laboratories on their grounds. Because they say they were like factories, they stink up the place. Seriously, right? The first, you know, the first major industrial laboratories were in the polytechnics and so forth. But for the elite universities, it took a long time for them to come on board and fully incorporate that kind of mentality of the industrial culture that experimentation was very much part of. And I think we're suffering through a similar kind of culture lag at the moment with regard to information technology. But eventually the universities will come around. And what we need is just sort of dynamic leadership to kind of push this through and to not see the world of Silicon Valley as just the other of the university.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
How do you see the assessment within a university working in these kind of new interdisciplinary hybrids? Who judges, for example, when the student work is good, when there are no disciplinary criteria for work anymore, if that happens?
Well, I do think, you know, this, you know, one thing that one might do, I mean, for just talking about this in a very practical kind of way, is actually have the student dictate the terms, by making a contract arrangement where the student dictates the terms of accountability. Right? I mean, obviously you'd want to put some scope around that so the student just says, well, if my mate down the hall likes it, it's cool. No, you don't want to do that. But in principle, to have, you know, you put certain kinds of criteria that a contract would have to satisfy, but then say, look, the student can kind of dictate the terms. So for example, you might say, it's not so important that you, Carl, who's a great academic, really get what I'm doing, but it's important, you know, if somebody who is running some kind of R&D division somewhere understands it. Right? But the point is, it's a contract where there's a kind of accountability that's understood in the outset. That's the way I'm, you know, just an off-the-cuff response to your question. Yes, sir?
In terms of the practical application that you're going to make, would it sit more in the sort of paradigm shift idea, or as a sort of almost a new discipline, like where you were saying disciplines developed in the first place?
My view, I mean, the thing about disciplines that in a sense I'm most worried about losing in the kind of picture that I'm talking about is method. Because one of the strong points of disciplines is that it becomes a kind of a, there's an incentive to kind of get clear on technique and method and getting clear about what you can and cannot do as a result of using certain kinds of methods. And I am a little concerned that if we got rid of disciplines altogether and we're constantly just paradigm shifting, that method would kind of get lost. And method is a really important thing for judging validity, right? Whether you have, you know, applied the right method, what is the right method to apply. And disciplines, I think, have a lot of their intellectual power. I would say that most of their intellectual power comes from method. And that, I think, is the tricky thing, that we need to be able to continue to... So you all learn mathematics, and you all learn how to observe things properly. All this kind of stuff needs to be preserved.
Yeah. One more, and I'm going to wrap it up. Yeah.
So would you then instead really welcome, as a judging criteria, the process of someone's work?
Well, the process is important, but you have to also have a sense of what the work is trying to do. Right? I mean, process by itself isn't sufficient. This is my point.
But judging what it's trying to do surely would define it into a kind of, almost like a category of...
No. This is where, in response to Carl's question, I think with these kinds of projects, the students should set out the sphere of accountability they want to be held accountable to, right? So in other words, if you're working on some kind of project, who is in a position to judge whether the project is good or not? Who would you trust doing that? And so part of what you would do when you design the project is to actually have that in your mind. Namely, who could say this is good or bad? And just don't assume it's just the teacher, right? It could be someone else. And so that would be the way you would specify the goal. It wouldn't be in terms of necessarily already established disciplinary criteria, but it would be in terms of criteria that are pertinent to what you're trying to do. And who would be able to judge that? In other words, it can't just be you. It's just that you can't come to me and say, hey, I've been working on this, and I went through a great process, and had a lot of great thoughts, but it's kind of crap what I've come up with, so give me an A. You know, I mean, no, you see, that's not permissible. You have to kind of you have to have some sense of who could judge, other than yourself, whether this thing is any good or not. Because that would actually be one of the criteria by which to define this is actually a well-designed project. Because if you're the only one who knows whether it's good or not, you know, then you don't really have a proper project there. You see what I'm saying?
Are you around, Steve, for a couple of minutes?
Yes, I am around.
Can we thank Steve for a fascinating lecture?
Thank you.